Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowder, and they call me the Booker. With me today, my co-host from Highland Park, Texas. They call him the handsome half-breed, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
You know, when I was younger, I was going to say when I was a kid, but I think I was already in my 20s, so that doesn't really hold up. But I wanted to be Gino Hernandez, you know. I was the half handsome half-breed, except I wasn't handsome or a half-breed in any form. So, yeah, but I like that. That's pretty good. Every week people get so excited when you do about your whole Breaking Kayfabe intro and Breaking Kayfabe on life. Me personally, Jeff, I sit here and I go, what's he going to say this week? How will he introduce me? It's my favorite. It's my favorite part of the first 5 minutes of the show.
And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We'll break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. Barry, we in fact will break kayfabe, as they say, on life. But wait, it's time for this town to get down. You've got it. The Booker, Bowdrin the Booker, not burning up in here. We are in critical condition, babies, but you can tell where it hurts because I got the healing prescription right here on Breaking Kayfabe, 50,000 watts of intensive care, baby. So sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide and say, give it to me straight, Booker. I can take it. We are Breaking Kayfabe on fucking life, Barry.
Okay. Well, how's it going over there, Jeff? What did you do today? How did you spend your day?
Researching KRP on Google. That's what I did.
Man. Well, this has got, you know what? You can already tell we're about 90 seconds into the show, and I think the gloves are off. I think this is going to be fucking mass hysteria, chaos. It's going to be a
dogs and
royale,
cats living together.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I'm actually pretty excited.
Okay, so on today's show, here's what we're going to talk. We're going to have two more matches from Houston. These two, Barry, I think we both are in agreement, are really, really top-notch, easy for me to say, good matches that we're going to discuss. We are going to be also taking a look at the recent NXT pay-per-view. Barry will be offering some commentaries. I will be offering the pithy retort to his commentary. And then, as a special treat to you, the listener, we want to make you people happy. Our friend MD Tyler said, give us your top five movie quotes. We did those last week. This week, Barry, we're going top five. No, a special alert, not top five. Barry, boom, we are going top 10 funny movie quotes. I know you are stoked and ready to go, and we are hoping they're all, not all, Big Friggin' Lebowski.
Nope, just about 50%, and the other 50% will be Fletch. But I'm real excited too, and pardon me too. I'm real excited to talk about the two matches, and it's such a huge find, you know, to find all this Houston stuff, to see Paul Bosch in living color, to hear Paul Bosch. This has been a real treat. And when I watched these two matches a couple of days ago, I actually stayed on the channel to see what else was there. And next thing I know, it's like 3 hours later and I've just watched seven matches. It's like, wait a minute, I don't have time for this. But this Houston stuff has been a real find.
Absolutely. So before we get to the Houston matches, though, by the way, for our friend John Doe, I would just want to say that they call me Mr. Integrity. I promised him I would do that. So, Barry, let's talk, before we get to the Houston matches, let's talk about the recent NXT event that happened before SummerSlam. Good, I almost said the Royal Rumble. So, Barry, why don't you offer us some quick opinions, some thoughts, some views, some comments, if you will, on the recent NXT show.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So I really look forward to these NXT takeovers. I'm not alone in that either. I think if you're a diehard fan, you view NXT takeover, you're almost guaranteed it is going to be a better show than the show that it is preceding. So, you know, in this case, it was SummerSlam, but whether it's WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Survivor Series, we get one of these takeovers when we're really excited about it. This one, first I should say, this was not the best NXT takeover. This was still a very good card. Pardon me. By comparison to SummerSlam, it was better. I actually thought SummerSlam was actually a decent show as well. What was unusual about this one, first off, it had a 7 o'clock start time. So that kind of threw me off because I sat down to watch the pre-show at 10 after 7 and then, wait, the first match is already on? So I didn't get any warning, and I don't know, you know, maybe I'm not looking at the network or whatever, but that kind of caught me off guard. And then the show only goes, you know, two or three hours, 2.5 hours, something like that. So, and it was 5 matches, 5 matches. I thought it was a really good show. But again, if I'm comparing this to other NXT takeovers, it wasn't one of the stronger ones. That being said, let's look at some of the matches. So the Undisputed Era, Kyle O'Reilly and Roderick Strong defending the NXT tag titles versus Mustache Mountain, who is the British wrestlers Trent Seven and Tyler Bate. Tyler Bate has had some matches with Pete Dunne, over the British title. I forget exactly what they call that British title. And those matches are out of this world. This Tyler Bate is, he's got to be, what, 5'6", 5'7". He's got legs like he's a football player, but he can do some amazing stuff in the ring. Trent Seven was his trainer, if I'm correct. And I haven't seen a whole lot of Trent Seven. This was really one of the first times I was able to sit and watch a Trent Seven match. And I guess it was unusual. I don't know what I was expecting with Trent Seven, but he's got a little more of a gut, and he doesn't look as menacing possibly as Tyler Bate, who really doesn't look menacing either. But they made a good team. But this Roderick Strong and Kyle O'Reilly, the Undisputed Era, whether it was Bobby Fish and O'Reilly, Fish being injured, now it's Roderick Strong. These guys are really good. And, you know, the mantra in the WWE is, when are these guys going to get called up? Selfishly, I sit here and pray that these guys don't get called up, because I know exactly what happens. History has shown us multiple times that when these really good acts in NXT get called up to the main roster, there is a big disconnect with the writers on the main roster, and these guys just kind of flounder. And I think the Authors of Pain, who were just, you know, if you would have told me that these guys weren't going to be money in the WWE, I would have slapped the taste out of your mouth. It makes no sense to me. They get up there now and they're like jobbing to Titus O'Neil and Apollo Crews and stuff like that. It's crazy to me, because these guys should be the next Road Warriors in a sense. And in my opinion, they're actually better than the Road Warriors. So Undisputed Era had what I thought was the match of the night, with Mustache Mountain wound up retaining the titles. So the next match was EC3 versus Velveteen Dream. And this was interesting to me on a couple of levels. Hey, Velveteen Dream is all of a sudden, he's the golden boy of wrestling fans, and maybe deservedly so, because he's really good in the ring. He works this gimmick. It's such a great fit. But EC3 to me is he's a paradox in the sense that I was a huge fan of EC3 when he was in Impact, TNA Impact, and we got to meet him. It was myself, my son, and Eric Chulminski, and it was one of the best interactions with a wrestler at a fan meeting that we've ever had. We all walked away and we're all like, holy shit, this is like the coolest guy ever. So EC3 had fans that night, and I loved him in Impact, and I don't know what it was. He was definitely protected in a sense, you know, with Impact, is that he was getting more screen time for interviews, which are kind of his strong point. He's not the greatest wrestler. If we're talking about in-ring action, he's not the greatest. And he's not terrible by any means. But for some reason, this, in my opinion, was the worst match of the night. And this is interesting. I mean, you and I talked about this off air, but one of our listeners, Kevin Orcutt, Kevin getting the shout out, said to me that this was his match of the night. And I think his reasoning was that they worked very snug, which they did, but they didn't seem to flow into gel. And I think a guy like Velveteen Dream works better with, say, a guy like Ricochet or somebody like that. But, you know, I still like this match. EC3 was busted open hard way at the end. Still a good match, just in my opinion, though not the strongest match of the night. The next match was really good, and it was Adam Cole versus Ricochet. And Ricochet, when he was in Lucha Underground as Prince Puma, I said for a couple of years that this, to me, was going to be the future. And he's very good. But Adam Cole, baby, Adam Cole is unbelievable. And I saw Adam Cole multiple times in ROH, you know, whether it was television or live. But you talk about a guy that is completely adapted to the WWE but is shining, and it's Adam Cole. And there was a spot where Ricochet was doing a backflip off the ropes, and Adam Cole caught him in a super kick midair. And holy shit, that was unbelievable. So Ricochet got the title. He won the North American title. But I don't think this feud is over. And Adam Cole is, I mean, this guy is going to be a major star. I should say, I believe this guy is going to be a major star in the WWE unless the writers completely fuck this up. Because you just talk about a guy who gets it, not from a psychological standpoint. 100% he gets it. The women's match, Shayna Baszler defended the NXT women's title versus Kairi Sane. So Kairi Sane catches a lot of heat online with the pirate gimmick, with her overselling of her facials. She's a strong worker, though, a strong wrestler, and the pirate gimmick, I could definitely see where it would turn you off. This was a good match. Shayna Baszler, to me, is a phenom. And I say that in the fact that she hasn't been in professional wrestling for too long. She is good at everything she does. She is, in my opinion, she's tied with Ciampa as the best heels in the business in the U.S. right now. I think the woman is tremendous. When she lost the title, my first fear was, my God, please don't call her up to the main roster the next night, which we've seen multiple times that this happens. She is fantastic. She naturally gets heel heat when she smiles and walks into the ring. But her actions in the ring, again, this is a psychology thing. How does somebody who's only been wrestling for a year, maybe a year and a half, completely get it like this? It's almost a Kurt Angle thing to me, because Kurt, right out of the gate, Dick Slater, guys like this in their first month of wrestling were really good. They got it. Shayna Baszler falls into this category. Main event of the night, Tomasa Ciampa defending the NXT title in a last man standing match versus Mr. Wrestling Johnny Gargano. So, good match, not the best match that they've had. And honestly, I think trying to top the last match was going to be a challenge, and it was. And the finish of the last match was one of these finishes that came out of nowhere and kind of screwed Johnny Gargano of winning. And I think we saw a similar finish this time, because Ciampa retained the title. He was handcuffed, but he was able to stand. Gargano hurt his knee and was not able to stand. And it was a good match, not their strongest match, but, you know, again, if we're putting stuff, if we're not comparing these matches to previous matches, this was a fucking unbelievable match. I just think they've got this legacy now that's really, really hard to live up to. But that being said, if you said to me, NXT is coming to town and WWE's coming to town, which I believe they're both coming up to the Philadelphia market in the next couple of months, I would go to NXT, and I would go to WWE if my tickets were comped. So I'll be making some calls to see if I can get comp tickets. But it was a good show. I enjoyed it. Again, that tag match was through the roof. I liked all the match. I'm a fan of wrestling. So for me, it's not, you know, that's one of the knocks about wrestling fans on the internet, and, you know, is that all they want to do is tear shit down. And honestly, that's the last thing I ever want to do. There is a guy on Facebook, and I'm not going to mention him by name, and I know our producer, the great Brian Last, and I have talked about him off air. But he is a guy that's been a wrestling fan for 40, 45, 50 years. And he watches every pay-per-view. He watches every television show the WWE puts out. And he criticizes it every single time. And this has been going on for years. And that, to me, is one of the greatest fucking wastes of time of somebody's life, in my opinion. But at the same time, if you don't like it, fucking flip the dial. You know, look, you don't watch WWE because you don't like it. That seems to make a lot of sense to me. You know, you don't like salad, Jeff, which is odd to me, but you don't like salad. Exactly.
So it's like the same thing.
Well, that's what I was getting to. It's a, come on, man. Everything relates to salad, just like in The Big Lebowski. Everything relates to Vietnam, right, for Walter. But it's not. It's not the same thing. But my point being, if you don't like something, you're not going to order it or waste your time on it. This guy, he fucking does. I'm the opposite. I like professional wrestling. I want to go into everything with an open mind and walk away and say, wow, that was really fucking awesome. And look, you and I, we're recording this prior to the ROH show on Saturday night. And, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you, when they do the television tapings, these things go on for like 6 hours. Like, it can be a challenge. But at the same time, there are nuggets of greatness thrown into those 6 hours. And I know that there's going to be points where you and I aren't sitting together. I think you're sitting with Eric Chulminski and I'm sitting with my son, but I'll be looking over at you going, did you fucking see that? Did you see that? And then we'll be talking about that on air at some point, I'm sure. So I liked WWE SummerSlam, which occurred the next night. But I got to say, and this is something I know you did not see or have any interest in, but on Monday night, the Shield reunited. So Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns, and Dean Ambrose reunited. And I got to admit, when it happened, I popped off my couch like I was a 12-year-old schoolgirl. I popped. And that, to me, as you know, Jeff, you've been a fan, you know, as long as I have, essentially. When we pop, that's what we're actually looking for. We're looking for that moment where we're like, holy shit. I had a holy shit moment on Monday night when the Shield reunited, because completely unexpected. And that, to me, look, this was a great 3 days to be a wrestling fan.
So here's some very brief observations on the NXT show. I did like the tag match. I thought, you know, one of the things, and, you know, this is just a little stupid observation that I liked about Mustache Mountain, is that the guy that, I'm sorry, could you please tell me his name, the guy that's like the older guy?
Trent Seven.
Is that he doesn't look like everybody else. He's got a little bit of a belly. He's got hair on his chest. When's the last time we saw somebody that, like, had hair?
Tell.
Yeah, I know. It's just like, no, yeah. Everybody now, look, they got the tattoos, the, you know, they're muscle bound. And yep. The fact that this guy looks a little different made that kind of interesting to me. I quite frankly thought he was probably the weakest of the four guys in there. It was a really good match, though. I did not care for the next match with EC3. I thought EC3 was probably the weakest guy on the show. And again, I'm saying this, I really don't watch the show religiously. So these are very cursory observations. I mean, for all I know, he could be, you know, stinking Sayama and just had a bad night. But the women's match, I really loved the finish to the women's match. I thought it was very inventive. Great. And the way they pulled that off was really, really big thumbs up to me on that. The Ricochet match, the spot that you talked about where Adam Cole caught him with basically a super kick as he was doing it looked like an acai moonsault where he's flipping back and caught him on the side of the neck. That was like all over the internet with the memes and the photos on just about every Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. It was all, and it was an amazing looking spot. And thumbs up to both guys on that. And the main event, I agree. I did not like this match as much as I liked their previous match that they had. It was a good match. Ciampa is just an amazing heel. He's like one of the best heels I've seen in, geez, I don't know how long. He just is very effective in his role. I just don't know where they're going to take this program if they keep going. Somebody pointed out that maybe they're going to do an angle where Gargano kind of starts losing it and, you know, goes kind of sideways in his relentless pursuit of the guy. But no, I thought it was a good show. Was it to me, it wasn't quite as good as their last show. That's just all I'll say. So now as we move along, Barry, we recently, at the time we're taping this, I think it might have been even yesterday, we heard the unfortunate news that Chris Champion had passed away. And I know Chris spent some time in Florida, and he also, of course, was one of the new breed up in Crockett land around 87. So why don't you regale the folks with some stories about Chris Champion's time in Florida?
Yeah, what a talent he was, too. So he was another one that was kind of right out of the gate. And Chris Champion came along, and I want to say it was around 85. And it was right around the same time as Sean Royal His brother was also a wrestler, Mark Starr, but Chris Champion had it all, in my opinion. So he could, he physically looked good. You know, he had this kind of natural physique. He was in shape, but he wasn't overly muscular. He was still kind of lean, kind of a Rick Rude look in a sense. Could really cut a promo, was really good on the stick right from the get-go. And then in the ring, he could do it. So, you know, Chris Champion to me was a guy that there were two guys towards the end of CWF that I'm like, okay, so Crockett, McMahon, they're going to get these guys. And that was Chris Champion and Ed the Bull Gantner. And Ed the Bull certainly wasn't at the level of Chris Champion, but he had something about him. He had a look as well that I could, you know, I just said, somebody's going to get a hold of Ed the Bull and he's going to do extremely well. Sadly, he got very ill right toward, he was supposed to go to Crockett apparently too, and got very ill right at the end of CWF before he went to Crockett, and it was kidney issues, ultimately led to real severe kidney issues and health issues, and he committed suicide. But Chris Champion was the other guy, and Chris Champion, I didn't see a flaw in his game. Certainly, you know, he had some issues outside the ring, which were well documented. I was reading, I guess he did a shoot interview over the last few years, and he talked about it, it was the car accident, and then Sean Royal quit the business, and they never went anywhere. But you know, I posted in the CWF Facebook group yesterday, and it was an article from one of the programs, and it said, "Meet Sir Oliver Humperdinck's new charges," and he had just started to manage Chris Champion and Sean Royal, and was putting them together as a tag team at that point. He was a real talent, and I just feel like, you know, whether it was the unfortunate car accident which derailed the new breed, and it just seemed like he never really got back on track. And I know when he went to Memphis, there were issues. I believe he admitted he was a heroin addict at one point when he was in the Memphis area, teaming with his brother Mark Starr as Wildside. There was allegations of sex with a minor, which how often do you ever hear that happening in the Memphis territory? Never.
Almost right? Never. Almost never.
Almost never. So there was that, and then he came back to WCW or the NWA as Yoshi Kwan, and I believe had a knee injury or an arm injury, and then was gone again. And I just, you know, to me it was kind of sad, because anybody that knew this guy, and I met him once, he was a very nice guy, but I didn't know him. But anybody that knew him just said he was like the greatest guy. Like this, we're not talking douchebag here. That he was a really, really super guy. And you know, to die at 57, and he just, you know, he didn't really have a career, and he had had a stroke years ago, which I believe was facilitated by drug usage. It's just a real shame. And his brother died too. His brother Mark Starr, I want to say, was 50 or 51, and he died a few years back. So it's a real sad end. I had heard 2 or 3 weeks ago from a guy who wrestles independence in the Tennessee area that he had had a stroke and was in a coma and completely unresponsive, and they didn't expect him to make it. And I guess they had wound up cutting off the life support, and within 24 hours he had passed. But to me, just really sad, because again, supposed to be a great guy, and there was so much potential there, and he just never really lived up to it.
Yeah, you know, when I remember Chris Champion, I remember a guy who came off to me as really, really athletic, a guy that you could see with a couple of years under his belt really becoming a big star. The new breed was such a kind of an off the wall gimmick. But boy, and I mentioned this before, when they, you know, when they popped with the Beastie Boys song, I mean, the place just erupted, whether it was because of the new breed or because people liked that Beastie Boys song. You know, it just was a huge pop in the arenas and stuff. He also, while he was in Memphis, I believe he was Cowabunga, the wrestling Ninja Turtle. So now, Barry, after that sad bit of news we had to discuss, Barry, it is time for America's favorite game show. Do you know what that is, Barry?
I do. So this is an uplifting moment as we talk about something sad. Now I get to get laid. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what can be more positive than that? You know, so
nothing.
Barry,
absolutely nothing.
I'm going to give you a treat, my friend, because I'm throwing three winners at you. And for the sake of our game, I'm going to let you choose these women from when they were in their proverbial prime. Are you ready to go?
Oh, I am.
Close the door. Don't let Mrs. Rose hear this part of the show. Barry, F, marry, or kill. I'm giving you Alyssa Milano, Kim Basinger or Samantha Fox?
Ah, easier than you think on this one, too.
Really?
So I am going to, maybe not as easy maybe as I first thought. I'm going to kill Kim Basinger, but that it's not a reflection on her. I am going to F Samantha Fox, because really that's what Samantha Fox presented herself as, very effable. But I'm going to marry Alyssa Milano, because much like everybody else, I had a crush on Alyssa Milano at one point, as you probably did, as most of our heterosexual male population and listeners probably did also. We all loved Alyssa Milano. So, yeah, I would marry her, but Samantha Fox would get the big F.
I told you this, Samantha.
Or the little F. Yeah,
I'm sorry to hear that. Did I tell you the Samantha Fox story in relation to me? So when I first discovered Samantha Fox, and she was an amazingly attractive woman, I think I got a calendar, and it was a calendar that featured her, dare I say, partially clothed. And so I decided to, in my one-bedroom, exclusively male apartment, decided to put up a couple pictures of Samantha there for my own personal enjoyment.
How old were you here now?
This was pre Mrs. Bowder number two. So okay. I'm going late 20s. Okay. So then, of course, in a burst of incredible intellect, I decided to invite the future Mrs. Bowder number two over for dinner one night. And as she walked in, I suddenly was hit with the realization, oh, shit, I got all these naked pictures of Samantha Fox in my apartment. She was extremely amused by the fact that I had this. And, yeah, that evening didn't go well. And the Samantha Fox posters and photos were soon removed at the bequest of the future Mrs. Bowder number two. So, yeah, good choices, good times, good memories of Samantha. Actually saw her in concert at a local nightclub as my boy friend of the show, Dave Flaherty, hooked me up with a pass, and he and I went to see Samantha at a local club because she was, of course, a singer of some note. Well, you know.
Her big song? She had a big song, right?
I couldn't even begin to tell you. But she did.
It
she had
Naughty
one...
Girls,
yes,
Naughty Girls
yeah.
Need Love Too?
It was something like that. Yeah, she had like a dance club single that was pretty
right.
well received and got a lot of play. But so anyway, that being said, good choices. I can't say I disagree. I would go with the F on Samantha, too, for obvious reasons that have been stated. So now, Barry, let's go to Houston, Texas. Let's discuss a couple matches that we found on YouTube. We discussed Houston wrestling promoter Paul Bosch last week. We are going to start off with April 21st, 1979. It's the spoiler Don Jardine facing off with Wahoo McDaniel. Before we start, a thought came to me as I was riding home tonight. You know, when you hear about the Observer Hall of Fame or some of the other different Hall of Fames, not the WWE Hall of Fames, the actual Hall of Fames, you know, one of the things that I've always read that Dave had said in the Observer is one of the demarcation lines is Dick Murdoch and Wahoo McDaniel. Were they better or worse than Wahoo McDaniel and Dick Murdoch? So now that being said, do you think that Wahoo McDaniel is Hall of Fame caliber?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's even a question. And so Wahoo, so we do, and I've discussed this, we do in the CWF group, we do a Hall of Fame. And we're going to be doing voting for the next round probably in the next month or so. And Wahoo is not in. Now, granted, we've only got maybe 30 people in. So Wahoo at some point would be in. I believe Wahoo should be in every Hall of Fame. And I base that off of quality of matches, length of career, and the fact that he headlined literally almost every territory with the exception of, say, the WWWF, which, if you know the story, there's a reason why he didn't headline that territory, but he was there when he was first starting out. But Wahoo should. I guess the knock on Wahoo would be towards the end of his career when he wound up in the AWA and then was working. And, you know, he was older. He was heavy. He was in 50 at that point, or certainly close to it if he wasn't 50. But to see Wahoo in his prime, and I think we're seeing a Wahoo, you know, who is certainly close to being in his prime in this match. You know, this guy was phenomenal. And those chops, you know, I've talked about it previously, and Pete Lederberg and myself, we would go see wrestling in West Palm Beach at the Leaky Teepee in the West Palm Beach Auditorium, and Wahoo would be having these chop fests with Mr. Saito, and literally you could be way up in the rafters and you could hear these chops connecting. And, you know, it isn't like the chops now where everybody does this, or like Japan, but we're talking 1978. Nobody else was doing that. So to me, Wahoo, absolutely. And Dick Murdoch should be in a Hall of Fame. How do you not, if you have a legitimate Hall of Fame for professional wrestling, how isn't a guy like Dick Murdoch going to be included?
Yeah, no, I asked the question, and my own belief is that Wahoo definitely belongs. You know, the interesting thing about this match is that I found this match, and I guess I was looking for the date on it or something like that. I did a Google search, and I came up, and I don't know what the guy's name is, but someone had done a listing of his own personal match of the years, and he gave this match 1979's match of the year. And I got to tell you, Barry, this is one hell of a throwdown, nothing but action match, and I thought it was a very, very good match, very strong. What did you think?
Yeah, I loved it. Look, this is if you were going to ask me my favorite era of wrestling, it would have been an era of 75 to 79 in Florida. And I would say, you know, 75 was my favorite year, but these two guys beat the shit out of each other on a nightly basis in 1978 through every arena in every little fucking National Guard armory in the state of Florida. And, you know, whether it was Wahoo versus the Spoiler or tag matches of Wahoo and Dusty versus Spoiler 1 and 2, and Spoiler 2 was usually Bobby Duncan, these guys were having these matches that were just off the charts. And 78 was a great year. Attendance was really up in Florida, and I would attribute a lot of it to Wahoo was a guy that he had been around in the 60s, and we didn't see him for almost 10 years. I forget what year. I think he left 68, and we didn't see him again until 78. So I don't know what happened that it took 10 years for Wahoo to make it back to Florida, but he was a guy right out of the gate in his first week was already getting main events, and the fans took to him right away. There was no buildup of him having to win over the fans. He was the number two babyface behind Dusty Rhodes within 7 days. That's absolutely huge. Spoiler was another guy. Spoiler showed up in Florida, and he had 3 runs in the state of Florida. And he just was a guy that, again, right out of the gate, he was physically fit, which we talked about last week. He was imposing. He was a good interview because he was menacing. But he was a guy who was believable. He was absolutely, you know, here's a guy wearing a mask, and I'm saying he's believable. He was really believable, and he just did a great job. Didn't have a manager when he was here in Florida during his first run, which is unusual because he almost always had managers with him. But I love this match, and, you know, I liked everything about it from A to Z. I liked the interview prior to the match with Wahoo, and Paul Bosch, and Paul, God bless Paul Bosch, because I would have, you know, I consider myself fortunate, having being fortunate enough to be able to see Gordon solely on a weekly basis. But if it's not Gordon or Lance Russell, I would have loved to have had Paul Bosch commentate my television on a weekly basis, because he seems so genuine and so natural in front of the camera. I really like him. And when I watched the first match a couple of weeks back, it took me a few minutes. I was like, I don't know, man. Paul Bosch by himself with nobody else just doing the commentary, I don't know if I'm going to dig it. And then I really started to like it. But he mentions to Wahoo, Wahoo's got a necklace around his neck, and he mentions the necklace to him, and Wahoo looks at him and goes, "Indians like shiny things."
Yeah, I definitely caught attention to that. Yeah.
He says it twice. It's a really odd thing to say, but then they start talking about about the U.S. American title or American U.S. title, whatever they're calling it, and then they both say, "Indians like shiny things." So I thought that was interesting. The crowd's a little quiet in the beginning of this match too. There's definitely a build to get things going. Danny McShane is the ref. Danny McShane setting a world's record for being the oldest ref in a match. He's 140 during this match, which I did not know. I had to look it up and see. But all kidding aside, Danny McShane was a fantastic wrestler, heel, I think going back to the 1930s. And then I think retired in the 60s, though he was still doing special matches in the 70s, but he's, and I'm actually very good friends with his nephew on Facebook, who runs a Facebook group. But Danny is elderly in this match, and it doesn't quite work. And I have a lot of respect for Danny Machine, so I don't want to you know. But
just for a second.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I've heard about Danny McShane, and
sure.
Let's throw this out there just off the cuff. I don't know if this is absolutely the God's honest truth, but I'd heard that Danny McShane may have, in fact, been the guy that was the first guy to use the blade, because he was involved in a lot of blood matches in Texas and the Houston area back in, I want to say late 50s, early 60s. And I think I've read that Danny McShane may have been the first guy to use the blade. So anyway, just thought I'd throw that out there, a little piece of trivia. Yeah.
And I want to say he partook in one of the first steel cage matches when it wasn't even a cage. I think it was like a wire fence or a chicken fence match. I want to say he was part of that. But I mean, here's a guy. So, you know, I do a lot of research when it comes, and I go through all these old newspapers, and Danny McShane falls into the Lou Thesz category. You can put in Danny McShane, August 23rd, 1938. And it's going to give you a listing for Danny McShane. So much like Lou Thesz, these guys worked 7 nights a week for decades. And Danny McShane was everywhere. Really interesting. It's just, you know, you put Danny McShane in a match where it's obviously not easy for him to get down and count. There's one point where he's counting down somebody, the Spoiler or Wahoo, and he's literally over the two guys as he's counting them because he can't get to the other side because he's elderly. So I think maybe in those days fans looked past that, and it was like, you know, maybe not, you know, but maybe they did. Maybe it's like, oh, it's Danny McShane, you know, he's a legend. He worked Texas going back 40 years. You know, so maybe there was a different way, but it reminded me a little bit of Gene Kaniski, if you remember that match, Flair versus Race.
Sure, Starrcade 83.
Yeah, and Kaniski was, and God bless Gene Kaniski, but he was a detriment to that match, without a doubt.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of that, but any case, Spoiler wins the first fall with the double axe handle off the top rope. Wahoo is a bloody mess, which literally you can repeat that during a Wahoo match. He's a bloody mess. Wahoo wins the second fall with a chop and a pin, and Wahoo's chops are cool, and Spoiler does a great job of selling them. Wahoo will whip the Spoiler into the ropes, give him the chop, and then the Spoiler will fly another 6 or 8 feet and sell that chop, and I just thought that was great. Wahoo winds up turning the Spoiler's mask around, and Spoiler, not being able to see, he then drags Gary Hart into the ring. He's got the claw on him, releases Gary Hart, and then he puts the claw on Danny McShane. So, God, you know, that's elder abuse right there. He's got McShane down. He's got the claw on him, and then Wahoo comes over and starts chopping away and breaks it up. They go outside the ring. Spoiler's DQ'd, I guess, for putting the claw on McShane. They're brawling outside the ring, but this is a good match. And what I liked about it, I mean, I liked everything about it, but I liked the fact that it definitely told the story, because you and I have discussed that previously. And when I've been critical of current wrestling, it's generally there's no story being told. And I like a story in wrestling. And there was a story here. And the fact that they build up, they don't come out of the gate, you know, hitting each other with chairs and stuff like that. It takes a couple of minutes, and you watch the crowd, because the crowd is pretty quiet for the first 4 or 5 minutes. And by the end of this match, people are standing up and they're waving their arms and they're screaming. They're totally into it. So this was a really, really enjoyable match.
Yeah. You know, you pretty much hit all the points that I'd made in my notebook, but you know, one thing you didn't hit on that I thought was pretty interesting is at the very beginning of the match, when they're doing the intros, each guy, you know, the Spoiler has Wahoo McDaniel and the Spoiler has Gary Hart, I believe. Wahoo has some random guy and they didn't introduce the guy, but it's just some guy who, you know, he takes his apparel and goes out. And there, I think there's a point in the match even where the guy jumps up on the ring apron to complain about some spot that's going on with the spoiler taking advantage of Wahoo. And I'm sitting there going, who the hell is this guy? Because they're like not, you know, I don't know if it's some guy from the Kiwanis Club that got seats at ringside. But I just thought it was.
Kiwanis Club, repping. Absolutely.
That's our first reference.
Line of the night right there, Jeffrey Bowden. I don't know if it's a guy from the Kiwanis Club. Absolutely. So I think in Houston, and I think Atlanta was like this, because when I saw a couple of cards, and you saw cards in Savannah, but I saw a couple of cards in Atlanta in the mid-70s, and they used to have a guy, and I don't think he was a referee, but he would be wearing an NWA shirt. So he had a shirt with an NWA patch, and then he would take the jackets. So he was essentially the jacket guy. That's what I think it is here. But I noticed last week, this week, I think there's three of these. There's the ref, Danny McShane. Then there's two of these guys. And I think there's a second ref outside the ring. And then there's a guy from the Kiwanis Club who's taking the apparel, the gear and shit. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, but then, no, again, this is a really – the guy where I found this said it was the 1979 match of the year in his eyes. And I don't know if it was the match of the year, because in 79 there was a lot of great friggin' wrestling going on. But this is absolutely a really good match, and I have no problem stating that. Okay, now, Barry, we're going to go to 1982 at September 3rd. Now here you can see that something has happened within the promotion, because now the people that were wrestling in Southwest for promoter Joe Blanchard have begun to take hold of the main events in Houston. And that night we had the team of Gino Hernandez and Tully Blanchard taking on Ken Lucas and Ricky Morton. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match, and you've been talking about it to me for 2 weeks. Tell me what you thought.
I love this match. This is of the matches we've discussed over the last month or so, this might be my favorite match, and there's a bunch of reasons for it. So the history of Houston, and I'm no expert on this whatsoever, and I'd be actually interested, but I know that at some point, I guess, Bosch separated from Fritz, and they weren't working together any longer, and then he hooked up with Southwest. Southwest went under, and then he hooked up with Mid-South. So I don't know the lineage exactly how all that worked. But I'd be curious if anybody out there does know, and I certainly could do the research, but I really like this match, and I have been telling you for the last couple of weeks, like, wow, I thought this was great. So Ken Lucas and Ricky Morton were tag team champions, a couple of years earlier in Memphis, and they held the Southern tag titles three times in the Memphis area. And Ricky Morton has given, I know I've seen this in shoot interviews, he's given Ken Lucas a lot of the credit for his success. And it's a lot of it was, he said that he learned more from Ken Lucas than anybody in professional wrestling, that Ken taught him. And they obviously, there was some kind of rapport here, because in Memphis, I think this was one of these tag teams that was just kind of thrown together. You know, Ken Lucas was a vet. He had been wrestling for, you know, 20 years at this point, give or take. I don't know what the length of time was. And Ricky Morton was still fairly new in 1980. So, you know, they put the young rookie with the vet, and Lucas, they must have formed a real friendship here, would be my assumption, because Morton holds Ken Lucas in the highest regard. And it's interesting because people that know and worked with Ken Lucas hold him in the highest regard. And he's a guy that for the current generation, they have no idea who he is, because his career really was over by the end of this run, by 82. 83, he was back down working in the smaller promotions in the South, maybe the Gulf Coast area and places like that. I think the notoriety he got was he was in a match, and I forget who his partner was, against the Road Warriors when they were in the AWA, which I guess would have been 85 or 86, and it turned into a bit of a shoot, I guess. They started really roughing up Ken Lucas, and he was fighting back, but I guess wasn't a match. I haven't seen the match in years. I'd be curious, but Ken was a guy that we also, and this is where everybody sits on Grandpa's lap, and I start to regale you with stories of the old days, but he was Florida Tag Champion in 1976, and he came in was only around for maybe 4 or 5 months and formed a team with Mike Graham. And this was kind of in between Mike Graham finishing up with Kevin Sullivan prior to his team with Steve Kern. So it was a patchwork team. I think they were looking for something to do with Ken. What should we do with him? And certainly, you know, hooking him up with Mike was a good move. They formed a really good tag team. They had a feud with the Hollywood Blondes, and I believe the Blondes injured Ken, and then he was out of the state. But he was solid. He was a guy. You know, the Gulf Coast was such an interesting region, and we certainly don't give it a lot of love. But you know, guys like Ken Lucas were the mainstay there for a decade, maybe even longer. And you know, there were certain guys: Cowboy Bob Kelly, Ken Lucas, the Fields brothers. But Ken Lucas, you watch this match, this guy had it. You know, he doesn't look, he's a little shorter, he's a little heavier, but everything he does in the ring is spot on. His punches are great. And Ricky Morton, I know in one of the interviews, has said that he learned more of how to be a babyface from watching Ken Lucas than watching anybody else in professional wrestling. And when you watch Ken Lucas in this match, you fully understand that comment, because he does such an amazing job of relating to the crowd, and just everything he does is great. So the match starts out with the heels attacking the baby faces. The baby faces recover quickly. They clear the ring. They throw the heels over the top rope, and it leads to a DQ in the first fall. The babies win the second fall with a sunset flip. The heels win the third fall with Tully pinning Morton after a pile driver from Gino. And it's a great spot. It's like one of those spots that you got to pay attention to. I just thought this match on every level was so good. And I know we've discussed this prior, and I completely forget the answer, which is why I'm going to ask it again. But better team, Gino and Tully or Gino and Chris Adams?
Yeah, I think we have addressed that before. I think perhaps in the ring, maybe Gino and Tully were better. I think Gino, you know, we use this excuse on the, you know, different versions of Midnight Express. I think Gino and Tully may have been better in the ring. Gino and Chris were better as heels. And just because they were more over with, you know, having the Von Erichs and stuff like that. And obviously, I don't think Morton and Lucas were as over, obviously, as the Von Erichs were. You know, one thing that I was thinking of as you were talking about Ken Lucas. Ken Lucas, I know when he was, whether it was Gulf Coast, Southeast, whatever, in that general Alabama, Florida panhandle region, I remember he had a pretty well thought of match with Jack Briscoe when Jack might have been the world champion. And one that, like, Jack, I think, had said was one of his better opponents. And a guy that really, you know, handled himself in the ring as a president. After the match is over, Gino and Tully go back and do an interview with Paul Bosch. And apparently they're getting ready to face at the next card. They're going to face Mil Máscaras and Dos Caras. And Gino says, bring on those wetbacks.
Go ahead. He does. And I actually made a notation. I said, Gino's racist comments after the match.
Yeah, he says, send him across the river.
Yeah, holy shit.
Yeah, it's things that you could not say today. Yeah, no, definitely you could not say it. But yeah, no, this was what you would call the proverbial Southern style tag team match, and very well done. Both teams really shining. What kind of surprised me was after the first fall, which was done like literally within 50 seconds. But that second one was the baby faces really dominated the action for the better part of the rest of the match. Before the heels ultimately took the final, you know, the final pin. But that was kind of a little bit surprising to me. But no, good solid action. Gino and Tully were really, really good. You know, kind of doing the underhanded, sneaky heels tricks. And Morton, who at this point he was so young, he didn't even have his mullet yet. But you look at Ricky Morton in this match, and you just say, wow, yeah, this is the guy that you could easily see was going to be a real big star. He hits Tully Blanchard with this drop kick and completely potatoes him. When we post the match on the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook page, you'll have to look for that point in the match, because he nails Tully pretty damn good in that thing. So, okay, Barry, it is now time for us to appease our fans and our friend MD Tyler, who came up with the suggestion.
You made a comment, and I think you are right, because I remember this. But we have to look at the gravity of what you said, which was you were basically quoting Jack Briscoe. So Jack Briscoe, and I do realize a great portion of our audience never saw him, but at the same time, Jack Briscoe faced everybody from 1965, I believe was when his first match, up until 1984. And as world champion, he held that title for 2.5 years. He faced, you name it, he faced everybody and their mother. And as he continued to work in Florida and then went to the Mid-Atlantic and then the WWF, he continued to face all the top names in pro wrestling all across the world. For him to say that Ken Lucas was one of his best opponents, the gravity of that is absolutely huge. It really is. I don't want that to get lost.
No. There's no question. You know, obviously Jack thought very highly of Ken Lucas. And again, your point is a valid one. When we post this match and the match starts, people are going to look at Ken Lucas and go, who the hell is this guy? He looks like a short, he basically has a body like kind of like Les Thornton used to have, you know, short, kind of chunky, but like solid guy, you know. And but no, this guy was every bit as solid in the ring as he was as far as his physique and the way his general appearance was. So, okay, now we're ready to go, Barry.
Now we're ready to go.
You ready, sir, to do some funny movie quotes? Before I do, I have to say, get ready, folks, because this could be the dirtiest segment in history based on some of the quotes that I have to let fly. So if you're a fan of the F word, get ready, because we're going to hook you guys up with a few of these things. So, Barry, we're going top 10. Let's not make this a 3-hour show. Go. Number 10. Favorite movie funny quote.
Jeez. I mean, okay.
Oh, and by the way, okay. let me just say, Barry.
Yeah.
I can tell the folks. Usually, we give each other a little bit of a hint of what's on the other person's list. No hints. Yeah. So we're going completely unscripted on this one.
Yeah, we're going completely unscripted. I've got a list. It's probably, and actually, I don't have the F word, so I may just throw in some obligatory fucks on my list because I don't actually have a lot of. But yeah, so I'm going with 1980s Caddyshack, Rodney Dangerfield, as he's out on the golf course. Hey, everybody, we're all going to get laid.
That's a fair opening. And it's funny you mention that because my number 10 is also from Caddyshack. Barry, we're going Carl Spackler talking about his adventures with the Dalai Lama. He says, so I jump ship in Hong Kong and I make my way over to Tibet and I get on a looper. And of course, over the Himalayas, a looper, you know, a caddy, a looper, a jock. So I tell him that I'm a pro jock. And who do you think they give me? The Dalai Lama himself. 12th son of the Lama, the flowing robes, the grace, bald, striking. So I'm on the first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and he whacks one, a big hitter, the Lama, long into a 10,000 foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. Do you know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga. So we finish the 18th, and he's going to stiff me. And I say, hey, Lama, how about a little something, you know, for the effort, you know? Well, the Lama says, there won't be any money, but when you die on your deathbed, you will receive total consciousness. So I got that going for me, which is nice. The great Bill Murray.
Wow. Very nice. And I've got several Bill Murray quotes that I've made the list. And I think it's one of the most quotable guys probably in the history of movies, especially if we're talking about comedy. So I'm going to pull a Bill Murray quote. It's going to come, but it's actually Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, and it is the recruiter when they are joining the army. And it's from the movie Stripes, which you and I have talked about, one of the greatest movies in the history of film. And the recruiter looks and goes, now, are either of you homosexuals? And Bill Murray look at each other with lovingly eyes and go, you mean like flaming? Or recruiter goes, well, it's just a standard question we have to ask. And Russell Zisky replies, no, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn. And Bill Murray replies, yeah, would they send us someplace special?
Great quote. No question about it. My number 9, Barry, comes from The 40-Year-Old Virgin, came out in 2005, and it's the conversation that Andy has. Oh, my God, this is going to be so troubling if some people I know listen to this. Andy is trying to explain to his coworker, whose name is Mooj, that he's, in fact, a virgin. So Mooch says, Andy, don't let them bother you. It's okay not to have sex. Not everyone's a pussy magnet. You are what, like 25? Well, I'm 40. Holy shit, man. You got to get on that. Life isn't about sex. Life is about children and passion and spirit. Yeah, life's about passion. It's not about fucking and balls and pussy. It's about love. It's about people. It's about the connection. Yeah, Andy says, it's all about connections. It's not about tossing salad. It's not about cock and ass and tits. And tits, and butthole pleasures. It's not about butthole pleasures at all. It's not about these rusty trombones, the dirty Sanchez's. It's not about the rainbow showers and the camel toe slide and your Cincinnati bow tie and your Arabian goggles or the hot cart and the pearl necklace or pussy juice cocktails and the jagged little dildos and the double-decker pussies. Oh, yeah, the double-decker pussies. Shit-stained balls and cum swapping. The hanging brain. It's not about the rattlesnake wiggle. And the alligator fuckhouse, donkey punching and teabagging. Would you please just stop, Andy says. And I have to include this whole sequence because I can remember literally in the theater having to catch myself because I was laughing so hard. It's so filthy and so dirty, but God, it was funny, Barry.
Yeah, I think we have to dedicate this episode to your mother.
Yeah, well, I'm sure she's going to enjoy that.
Listening is now clutching her heart and going, what? What did I just hear?
That's why I read it as fast as possible.
Yeah, I remember watching that movie, and I didn't see it in the theaters. I saw it, I think it was right after my daughter was born, and my wife and I were in bed watching television. I think we had our son with us. And the rest of the movie isn't as graphic nearly as that quote. And that quote came on and I was like, oh my God. And we like immediately paused. We got the kid out of the room and put the baby to bed. But yeah, that is really, really funny. So my next one is another Bill Murray quote from Ghostbusters 1984. We've been going about this all wrong. This Mr. Stay Puft is okay. He's a sailor. He's in New York. We get this guy laid. We won't have any trouble.
Great movie. Ghostbusters. Yeah. And let's say that is, of course, the original Ghostbusters, not that piece of garbage remake. Wow, the remake was just so horrible and so unnecessary. You know, and I think we mentioned it, Barry. You know, I just recently saw, it might have been like last night, they are remaking Papillon. I don't understand why you want to remake Papillon for the love of God. All right, next I'm going to, I want to say like 2005. It's Talladega Nights, and it's the scene where Ricky Bobby and Cal Naughton Jr. and Ricky's wife and the two boys, Walker and Texas Ranger, are sitting at the table getting ready to have dinner, and the grandfather, Chip, is telling Ricky Bobby that he doesn't appreciate the language of the boys. He says, I can't hold my tongue. These are my grandchildren and you're raising them wrong. They are terrible boys. And Walker, the little one, says, shut up, Chip, or I'll go ape shit on your ass. And Texas Ranger goes, I'm going to scissor kick you in the back of the head. And Cal Naughton says, yeah. And Ricky Bobby goes, yeah, turn up the heat, boys. Come on, boys. Come on. And Walker says, I'm 10 years old, but I'll beat your ass. And Texas Ranger says, Chip, I'm going to come at you like a spider monkey. And that was a great scene.
That is.
And it's funny because I'll tell you something. It is a very funny movie. But of all the Will Ferrell movies that I was referencing as I was going down this list, you know, I have to say Talladega Nights to me holds up. Anchorman, I've seen 15 or 20 times. And that does not hold up as well as I think Talladega Nights does. What do you think?
Yeah, I like both. Step Brothers is probably my favorite Will Ferrell movie, which I think maybe one of yours also. But yeah, I like his movies. There's definitely something. I take that back. Semi-Pro. Every time Semi-Pro is on, I stop, I watch, and I laugh my ass off. Have you ever seen that one?
Of course I have. And I'll tell you a very underrated movie that nobody gives a lot of love who are Will Ferrell fans is The Campaign with Zach Galifianakis. Have you ever seen that?
I have not.
Oh, my God. That is just hilarious. It's about how dirty a political campaign gets. And Will Ferrell just plays this vapid, completely airheaded guy who's been a congressman for like, I don't know, 8 or 10 years, who has these big high rollers that are bankrolling his campaign. And Zach Galifianakis is just some local schlub who works in the middle of downtown and decides to run against him at the last minute. And all it's It's really a funny movie, especially a lot of especially with everything going on in politics today. It's a lot. It's very very insightful in a very funny way. So
what was the movie that Will Ferrell did where his wife kicks him out of the house and he like lives on the lawn with like his clothes and furniture?
That, you know what? That was I can't remember the name of it. That was more serious Will Ferrell.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't like that movie. I watched it. I didn't like it, though.
Yeah. So next, my number eight, Barry, speaking of Will Ferrell, we're going to one of his movies, Anchorman, which I just referenced. But it's not Will Ferrell. It's the great Fred Willard, who in a scene is talking on the phone as Will Ferrell, I believe, walks into his office. And Fred Willard as Ed Harkin is talking on the phone. And he says, I have no idea where he would have gotten hold of German pornography. But you and I are mature adults. We've both seen our share of pornographic materials. Oh, you never have? Of course you haven't. How stupid of me. Neither have I. I was just speaking in generalities. Right. I'll stop by the school a little later, Sister Margaret. Goodbye.
Yeah, and I remember that, too. I think it was actually my turn, Jeff. And I think you somehow.
You did Ghostbusters.
Did we? All right.
And that was number eight.
Don't question me. Count.
Don't be questioning.
I can't count. I miss those old days when we couldn't even get to five without going, what number are we on? So yeah, I'm stuck there.
So you're number seven, Barry.
My number seven is, I'm dedicating this one to Sean MacGyver. So one night this week, this is the love that I have for our Facebook group. I had two threads. I was participating in two different posts, two different threads. One was quoting Lebowski and the other was quoting Fletch. And for me, I was just going back and forth. It was like a dream come true. So Sean MacGyver is a huge Fletch fan. So there's quite a lot of quotes. And we certainly we put forth about 50 quotes that night just back and forth. But there's a scene where he is he's getting an exam from the doctor. And the doctor is played by M.M.L. Walsh, who made my great character actor list. That has been in so many, and he was actually, I just watched it the other night, he was in Missing in Action. He was the guy that was working with Chuck Norris to get everybody out of there. So that guy's done so much work. So he's giving Fletch an exam, and he's talking to Fletch, and he's got the finger in the rectum. And Fletch is talking, and all of a sudden Fletch goes, Moon River, and he turns around and goes, using the whole fist, Doc, just like that. So that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah. And I know you're a huge fan of that. So my number seven, I'm going Animal House from 1978, and it is, of course, the classic scene where the members of the frat are called in front of Dean Vernon Warmer, as he goes over their different grade point averages and how disappointed he is. And the line goes, here are your grade point averages. Mr. Kroger, two C's, two D's, and an F. That's 1.2. Congratulations, Kroger. You're at the top of the Delta Pledge class. Mr. Dorfman, hello, 0.2. Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son. Mr. Hoover, president of Delta House, 1.6, four C's and an F. A fine example you've set. Daniel Simpson Day has no grade point average. All courses incomplete. Mr. Blue, and he notices that Bluto has pencil stuck up his nose. Mr. Blutarski, 0.0.
And it's such a great quote. And I listen to radio stations, you know, all, which is odd, all across the country. I'll listen to state. I like to listen to like entertainment. I don't like to call them talk stations, because you think of talk, you think of something generally fairly boring, whether it's political or something. These are more just goofy, like a Howard Stern type of deal. But that 0.0 drop is isolated and is played on almost every radio show across the country. My next one also comes from Animal House, and it's the classic line that I think we've all used anytime we have been in. And I'm going to use this at your daughter's wedding. I'm going to walk up to somebody and say, do you mind if we dance with your dates?
Yes, that was, they were going to see Otis Day and the Knights.
They were seeing Otis Day and the Knights, absolutely.
They may have stood out in that crowd, I'm just going to say. So,
Shamalama Ding Dong.
Exactly. My number six comes from 1980's The Blues Brothers. It's 106 miles to Chicago. We've got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it!
So I love that one. So let's make these two aren't going to count, but two of my favorite quotes ever come from this movie. They're not going to catch us. We're on a mission from God, which everybody knows that. But when the old man goes, "Where's my cheese whiz, boy?" For some reason, that cracks me up every single time.
Yeah, that's just that. You know, you literally, we could have done the whole list on just stuff from the Blues Brothers. You know,
yeah.
I love when they go see Mrs. Toronto. Torrentino, are you boys with the police? No, ma'am, we're musicians. And you know that whole. And then it's Jake Woods. Great to see you. How you been? You doing well? Where's our money, motherfucker?
Exactly.
Willie, too big haul. And then, of course, in memory of the great Aretha Franklin, you know, we're going to have four fried chickens, dry white toast. They look like a Hasidic diamond merchants. They look like they're with a damn CIA. Jake Elwood. So the Blues Brothers, they still owe you money, fool.
Jeff, I'm going to put the hardest question I think I've ever put forth, and I'm going to put it forth right now. Three classic comedies all playing at the same time. Which one do you watch? Animal House, Blues Brothers, or Stripes?
So this is like fuck, marry, or kill with movies?
But it's harder, I think. I think this is the hardest.
Jeez. I got to go. My number one would be, believe it or not, number one, Blues Brothers, number two, Stripes, and number three, Animal House.
Gotcha. So I'm close. My number three is also Animal House, which I feel terrible in saying that because it's such a great movie. My number one is Stripes. My number two is Blues Brothers. I could watch Stripes probably on an endless loop at this point. And I just, every time it just cracks me up.
Okay. You're number five.
My number five is actually a fairly current movie. I believe it came out in the 2000s, and it was Robert De Niro in Meet the Parents. When he looks at his future son-in-law, played
Gay
by
Focker. Ben.
Yeah. Well, right. Ben Stiller, who was, Gaylord Focker. And he says, "I have nipples, Greg. Would you like to milk me?" And I just remember walking around that night and saying that to my wife. "I have nipples, Jen. Would you like to milk me?" Yeah. And she didn't find it quite as funny as I did. Go figure.
She didn't take you up on the offer, obviously.
I was hoping. No, she did not.
Okay, my number five, also a movie from the 2000s. I'm going Me, Myself, and Irene, the Farrelly Brothers.
Oh.
And it's the scene where Jim Carrey, who has morphed into Hank, his darker side of his two personalities, is in the grocery store. Actually, he's Charlie at the beginning of the scene, and then he morphs into Hank in the middle of it, and a woman cuts in front of him and needs a price check. And Hank grabs the store microphone at the grocery store. That our friend Chris Zaha has probably dealt with this kind of thing in his grocery store before. And he says, "VagiClean, huh? What's the matter, honey? Little extra cheese on the taco? Excuse me? No, excuse me. There's no tag on this. Price check on VagiClean, aisle five. I repeat, price check on VagiClean, aisle five. That's VagiClean. We've got a customer down here with a full-on fallopian fungus. She's baking a loaf of bread, and I think it's sourdough."
Jesus Christ. Well, you did warn us.
I did.
He did.
Mom and Dad are still listening. Line. God bless them.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. Oh, there I am with that again, too. All right. Okay. So my next one, I am going. This is 1996. Happy Gilmore. And this is Happy Gilmore after his fight with Bob Barker. He looks at Bob and goes, "The price is wrong, bitch." I just got such a kick out of that.
You know, I have to tell you, I did not get into the whole Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore thing. I liked him in The Wedding Singer. I thought he was very funny in that. I liked Bobby Boucher what the hell is the name of that movie where he's the football player? Do you remember?
The Waterboy.
Waterboy. And I thought that was very amusing. But the earlier stuff, I know a lot of people just think that's the end all be all. And I didn't think it was as funny till later in his career. Okay. My number four comes from 1974, Barry. We are going Young Frankenstein. This is the scene where we have talked about great character actors before. And we had a great one here in the late Madeline Kahn, who played, she was originally Gene Wilder's girlfriend. She came and she falls in love with Peter Boyle, who plays the monster. She has sex with the monster, and a monster is leaving. And Madeline Kahn says, oh, where are you going? Oh, you men are all alike. 7 or 8 quick ones, and then you're out with the boys to boast and brag. You better keep your mouth shut. Oh, I think I love him.
Yeah, that's a good one. That absolutely is, too. So what year was that? Was 1974?
You know, the amazing thing that I discovered in doing a little research, Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles, which to me were the absolute zenith of Mel Brooks, both came out same year.
Wow.
That was a pretty friggin' good year for Mel Brooks.
Now, what year was Silent Movie?
That was closer to about 78, 79.
Okay, so that came out a couple years later.
Yeah. Not a lot of great quotes from that movie, needless to say.
No, yeah, we could do a whole hour on that one, no doubt. It would be a little quiet, but we could do it.
Exactly.
So my next one is 1998's There's Something About Mary. And it's the scene when Ben Stiller – so I'm 2 Ben Stillers in a row right here, which is interesting. When Ben Stiller is in the bathroom and has just gotten his man stuff caught in the zipper. And so he's in the bathroom. He zips up quick because Mary turns around and looks at him and thinks that he's pleasuring himself. So he's in the bathroom, and Keith David comes in. Keith David, who we've talked about from They Live with Roddy Piper, and he's been in a bunch of movies. And he goes, all right, boy, let me see it. And he looks at it, and he goes, what's that bubble there? And he goes, Ben Stiller goes, what do you think? And he goes, how'd you get the beans above the Frank? And Ben Stiller goes, I don't know. It wasn't like it was a well thought out plan. And when they bring him out, Warren, who's the mentally disabled brother, just keeps going, Frankenbeans, Frankenbeans. I thought that was so fucking funny.
Yeah, that was a great. That's another movie that we could have probably done about 10 quotes from. Okay,
yeah.
My number 3. I'm going 1974, just mentioned it, Blazing Saddles. Boy, talk about a movie you could not release today for oh so many reasons, Barry. This is the scene where Mr. Taggart, who's played by the great Slim Pickens, is discussing things with Harvey Korman, the great Harvey Korman in this movie, who plays not Hetty, Hedley Lamarr. So Taggart says, what do you want me to do, sir? He says, I want you to round up every vicious criminal and gunslinger in the West. Take this down. Taggart takes his pen, and Hedley says, I want rustlers, cutthroats, murderers, bounty hunters, desperados, mugs, pugs, thugs, nitwits, halfwits, dimwits, vipers, snipers, conmen, Indian agents, Mexican bandits, muggers, buggerers, bushwhackers, hornswogglers, horse thieves, bull dykes, train robbers, bank robbers, ass kickers, shit kickers, and Methodist.
There you go. I was going to pull a couple of quotes from Blazing Saddles, and I said, you know what, if I do that, Jeff is already going to have this movie on lockdown. And I just knew telepathically that you would have this movie on lockdown. So, yeah, that was a good one. My next one is easy. It's 1983's National Lampoon's Vacation, and it's the character, the security guard, Lasky, played by John Candy, when he utters the immortal words, sorry, folks, park's closed. Moose out front should have told you. And I can tell you every time I walk into a theme park, those are like the first words I always say.
Okay. That was a great movie, no question. My number 2 comes from 1999's Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. Austin Powers is in the nightclub when he comes upon a woman who says that my name is Robin Swallows. Austin says, Swallows, that's an interesting name. She goes, my maiden name is Spitz. And he says, well, which one is it, baby? Spitz or Swallows?
Ah, yes. This has been the hard R-rated version of Jeff Baudrin this week. This is the hard R with everything. So that is a good one. So I guess I'm coming up on number 1. I'm going to give a couple of my runner-ups that didn't make it. But that I was torn, and the truth was, you know, we've got 8,000 quotes on here, and I'm sure that when we're done recording this episode this week, I'll hang up and I'll go, motherfucker, how is I didn't do this one? And somebody will definitely call us out in the Facebook group, which both you and I enjoy so much. But runners up for me would be one of my favorite movies of all time, Real Genius, 1985, Chris Knight. Who is the character played by Val Kilmer, looks at the main protagonist in the movie and says, do you mind if I name my first child after you? Dipshit Knight has a nice ring to it. Raising Arizona, so another Coen Brothers movie. Nathan Arizona Sr., if a frog had wings, it wouldn't bump its ass a-hopping. Look, it is exactly 8:45 in the p.m., and I'll be down at the store in exactly 12 hours to kick me some butt, or my name ain't Nathan Arizona. And I can't tell you how many times I've said, if a frog had wings, it wouldn't bump its ass a-hopping. Ron Burgundy, Anchorman, this is your doctor. I have your pregnancy report here, and guess what? You got knocked up. And my last runner-up, the Black Knight, John Cleese, to King Arthur, Graham Chapman, after losing both arms in the heat of combat, and this was in Monty Python in the Holy Grail, he looks at him and says, it's just a flesh wound with both arms gone. But my number one is, guess what, from The Big Lebowski. Go figure. Who would have ever predicted this? Who? Everybody that knows me would have predicted this. But there are so many, you know, look, the whole movie is essentially quotes. It's not really dialogue. It's just a bunch of quotes thrown together. But there's one that I always just kind of laugh at, and it's when the dude has been called into the Big Lebowski's chambers, and they're discussing the fact that Bunny has been kidnapped, and the Big Lebowski is sitting in his wheelchair near the fireplace, and he says, "What makes a man, Mr. Lebowski?" And the dude goes, "Dude." And the Big Lebowski goes, huh? And the dude goes, nah, I don't know, sir. And the Big Lebowski replies, is it being prepared to do the right thing, whatever the cost? Isn't that what makes a man? And the dude says, sure, that and a pair of testicles. And for some reason, that always cracks me up. And that right there, that is dedicated to Dennis Bauer, one of the two Bauers that we have in our Facebook group, which is Dennis and Dima. I don't believe they're related. I believe Dima lives in Germany, and Dennis lives somewhere in our country. But Dennis and I were trading Lebowski quotes the other night for about an hour, which really is the most productive way, use of my time, for sure.
How can you go wrong there, you know? So
exactly. No paycheck this month.
I'll give you a few of my runner-ups. I won't go into the full quotes, because most of mine, instead of being a single line of dialogue or whole sequences of dialogue, I don't know if you notice. So I'm going to go 2009's excuse me, The Hangover, the sequence where Stu is confronted by his fiance about the fact that he's been in Las Vegas. Excuse me. And it is absolutely hilarious. 1976's Bad News Bears, where the kids are talking about Kelly Leak, Es Un Bandito. That was such a great scene. I talked about 2012's The Campaign, had some great quotes. Major League. The scene where Serrano is talking to the pitcher Ed Harris about whether or not Jesus Christ had a good curveball. So I had some from The Other Guys 2008 and the aforementioned Step Brothers from 2004. But you know, Barry, when I was sitting here and I was trying to decide what my number one quote was going to be, I realized that in this entire list, there's only one that has been a poster that I at one time in my life held or placed on my wall of my apartment. This is obviously pre-third Mrs. Bowdrin. And that is
Samantha Fox.
No, it's not, sir. That's number two. This is before number three. So, and that is the scene from 1997's Austin Powers when Dr. Evil sits down with his therapist and says, the details of my life are quite inconsequential. Very well, where do I begin? My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulanger, owner from Belgium with low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. My mother was a 15-year-old French prostitute named Chloe with web feet. My father would womanize. He would drink. He would make outrageous claims, like he invented the question mark. Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy, the sort of general malaise that only the genius possess and the insane lament. My childhood was typical. Summers in Rangoon, luge lessons. In the spring, we'd make meat helmets. When I was insolent, I was beaten with reed and placed in a burlap bag. Pretty standard, really. At the age of 12, I received my first scribe. At the age of 14, a Zoroastrian named Vilma ritualistically shaved my testicles. There's really nothing like a shorn scrotum. It's breathtaking. I highly suggest you try it.
You had that on a poster?
I had that on a poster in my apartment when I met my current wife.
Wow. And you? How many years are you married now?
15. Together, 19. She, yeah, it must have been the Dr. Evil poster that kept her hanging out.
Absolutely.
So anyway, so Barry, this has been a lot of fun. I'm sure right now there is someone out there going, I can't fucking believe you forgot this movie. So, you know, for all you people out there that can't believe we forgot this movie, what can I tell you? We forgot that movie. So, and we'll be having lots of fun on the message boards. Barry, anything else before we go? I've got a flight.
You got what?
I got a flight to catch tomorrow, so I got to pack my stinking suitcase and come up and watch some ROH with you, Barry.
Yeah, so we are recording this prior to the ROH show. So when this drops on Tuesday, we're recording this on a Thursday. The ROH show is in literally 48 hours from right now. It is a marathon too, though, and you'll see it. The show actually starts at 6 o'clock. They do the meet and greets between 4 and 6, and which is really everybody that's there. They'll do the meet and greets, and then the TV tapings will start. And I think they do 4 to 5 hours, and with breaks and everything, it literally will go for 6 hours. So it does become a marathon, but we have a pretty good group of people there. We've got some local Philly guys that are going to be coming out. Jamie Ward, is going to be there. Eric Chulminski is going to be there. But you got Ron Lemieux actually coming in from Connecticut. And Chris Qualman, I read, was possibly even thinking about coming up from the state of Florida as well, which, you know, that would be quite an event if that actually happened. So I'm pretty excited about this. I think we've got a fairly large group that night of guys getting together. So it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it. And I'm pretty much can guarantee that on our next episode, we will be regaling the good folks with stories from our weekend in Philadelphia, not just the ROH, but also, dare I say, Barry, we may be consuming some food while we're up there.
Yeah, just a little bit too. We've been discussing donuts a lot recently, and there was a big Dunkin' Donuts Krispy Kreme debate. And you know, look, my feelings on Dunkin' are well known. I absolutely hate Dunkin' Donuts, but I am going to take you to what is, in my opinion, the greatest donut place ever, but the greatest actual donut. And it is a donut. I'm losing my voice too. It's a Kroller donut, and it's kind of like a Krispy Kreme on steroids. But they make this donut with a French dough that's called pâte à choux. And pâte à choux is what they make the éclairs out of. So you get this flakiness of different layers of dough, but not flaky as in like dry, like moist and dough. And then they just cover it with this delicious glaze. So it was funny. I was trying to watch my weight and trying to eat a little bit healthier. And I think I was 48 hours and I discovered this fucking donut. And I was like, well, there you go. 48 hours, 30 over. And these donuts are absolutely incredible. So I'm real excited for you to try it. And Chris Spiker, who manages another donut shop in this area, is actually going to meet us and critique. Being in the business, we'll be there critiquing donuts with us on Saturday morning. So I'm pretty excited, but we're going to be eating a lot. I spoke with Jamie today, and we're lining up some places to go. We're probably going to eat before and after the event to give you the full true Philly experience, Jeff.
Well, I'll make sure and bring some antacid with me for the trip. So, okay, folks, I'm going to encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. You know, let me just say this one thing. The Breaking Kayfabe is part of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And, you know, there's lots of different podcasts out there for you to choose. But let's be honest. Who do they mention on, you know, the Jim Cornette Experience? Do they mention the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe? 2 weeks in a row, no mention. What the fuck's up with that, Brian Lath? Anyway, on that note, folks, we'll see you next week. Somebody call me a doctor.